It's a parent's nightmare. Your child goes in for surgery, but instead of getting better, she gets worse. All that Julia and John Hallisey could do was listen and watch over several days as their daughter lost blood pressure and kidney function and consciousness.
Finally, a resident came in and said, you know, we know what's wrong with your daughter. She has Staph aureus in her bloodstream. And my husband said, what does that mean? And I said, it's an infection. She had to have been infected in the operating room during her surgery.
Julia Hallisey stopped taking the word of the doctors and made it her own business to oversee her daughter's health. Along the way, she learned that there's a lot more that people can do to avoid the simple mistakes and infections that can happen inside a hospital, what it takes to be an empowered patient. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
I don't know if you've ever heard of something called the 5 Million Lives Campaign. It's a plan involving thousands of hospitals here in the U.S., a plan to fix one of their biggest problems, and that is the number of medical mistakes and unnecessary infections that afflict patients. The figures they have are quite frightening. The Institute for Healthcare Improvement estimates that almost half of all people admitted to hospital will experience some incident of harm, something done wrong or something that's not done, anything from a little mistake to a significant life-threatening event. This is the story of one mother who learned not to put up with it. Julia Hallisey first noticed something strange about her daughter's eyes when little Kate was about 5 months old. Julia's a dentist. She'd studied medicine, so she knew that it was serious when the doctors told her that Kate had bilateral retinal blastoma.
I remembered the word blastoma, and I knew that it was bad. Aggressive, fast-growing, destructive. We were dealing with something very serious and very aggressive. But we hadn't particularly studied eye cancer, so it was something very new to me.
Was this about the time that you started spending long periods of time in the hospital with her?
It was, because immediately when you have a diagnosis like that, there are tests that have to be done and scans, treatment plans are formed, and you basically start feeling like you're almost living in the hospital at that point. We were the first patients in the morning, so we got to the radiation oncology lab very early, about 7:30 in the morning. And because of her age, we just couldn't take the chance. You know, she wouldn't hold still, even in a type of restraint that they had for young children. So an anesthesiologist would meet us in the radiation oncology lab, and he would actually, you know, wave a little mask over her nose and put her under, and she would actually be put out for her radiation treatment, which was very short, but certainly, you know, she had the effects of the anesthesia for some time afterwards. So it was a long haul.
Yeah, how long did this go on?
This was about 6 weeks of daily radiation.
Well, I can imagine it being hard on her. I can imagine it being hard on you as well.
It's hard to explain what it feels like to see your child, you know, locked into this room. It looks like a vault and the door is slammed shut, and we had to wait outside and watch her on a TV screen and, you know, see this little light beam, you know, line up where the radiation was going to go, which was actually right through her temple area. So it's very terrifying.
The radiation worked for a while, but when Kate Hallisey was 2, the tumors came back. She had to have her right eye removed. Still, the cancer didn't go away. And now Julia's little girl is facing 2 years of chemotherapy.
Even though our oncologist had told us things like she probably wouldn't be that concerned about losing her hair because she was only 2, that was a huge event for her. And she was very distressed over losing her hair. She also had a central line put into her chest. So, you know, you can imagine a 2-year-old with a line coming out of their chest that's 8-9 inches long. So we would keep that taped to her chest and, you know, had to teach her not to touch that it was something important that we used for her treatment. So there were a whole new set of challenges with a 2-year-old.
Was there one point during this particular run of treatments that you had, Julia, when you or your husband said, okay, we need to start paying a little bit more careful attention to what's going on, or we've got questions and we're not getting the answers we want?
Well, I think what we realized at that point, and that was fairly early in the process, was that we could see a lot of communication glitches at the hospital. We could tell that people weren't reading the chart. Somebody would come in and say, oh, we better get this test ordered, but it had actually been completed the day before. Things like that that started making us kind of sit up and take notice and say, you know, I don't know if everybody's completely at the top of their game every day. We saw a lot of residents who were very, very impaired by fatigue. We certainly lived through several Julys where the new residents come in. They're very unsure of themselves or very inexperienced. We certainly dealt with medications not being given on time. The pharmacy staff seemed to be understaffed and overworked. Sometimes we waited hours and hours for medications that didn't come. So even though I wasn't thinking these things were particularly life-threatening at that moment, I certainly did realize that we needed to be there all the time.
Julia Hallisey started writing in a notebook to keep track of Kate's treatments. Julia got comfortable asking tough questions. One time her daughter was in the hospital and taking two different drugs. One was an antibiotic called vancomycin and the other a chemo drug called vincristin.
And the resident came in and she told me that she was going to order the vincristin for my daughter. So I interrupted her at least twice and said, you know, we are talking about vancomycin, an antibiotic, right? And she said, oh, yes, I'm sorry. I've been up all night. I'm exhausted. It's vancomycin. But then a third time, she referred to the drug as vincristin. So I stopped her and I said, you know, I'm really nervous. This is concerning me. Because if you give chemotherapy to a child that has no immune system and is having a fever, this could be life-threatening. And she's replied, don't worry, if I do order the wrong drug, the pharmacist would catch it. And I said, you know, that doesn't give me a lot of security because vincristin is a drug that my daughter takes.
Yeah.
So I could certainly see that drug being ordered and the pharmacist saying, oh, Kate Hallisey, yes, absolutely, and sending up chemotherapy for her. So, you know, I went to the head nurse and then I went to the chief resident and I said that I wanted her not to treat my daughter until she seemed like she was more well-rested and could gather her thoughts more clearly. And they were resistant to that. They said that, you know, this is part of the learning process and
learn on, you know, someone else's daughter. Please.
Yeah, she could probably, you know, get a good night's sleep and be a different person tomorrow. And I said, yeah. Well, then that needs to happen because this could really be a disaster waiting to happen. And it didn't, and it was averted, and perhaps she would have ordered the antibiotic. But when she told me three times that she was ordering a chemotherapy drug, I was very concerned.
Julia Hallisey discovered that most people in the hospital appreciated her help, her note-taking, that she was heard and respected. Well, then the family got a break. Little Kate was able to go home from the time she was 4 until she was about 8.
We call those our normal years. She did well. She was in school. We were happy. We were hoping that was the end. We weren't going to deal with those issues any longer.
And what was your thinking during those years, Julia? Were you thinking we're out of the woods, or were you always aware that, okay, we got to be watching?
Well, we were always aware that we had to be watching because our oncologist told us that when retinoblastoma affects both eyes, you do have a greater risk of cancer recurring and that it often recurred to the bones. So we were always watching, but we had really made up our mind that we weren't going to let that scare us. We weren't going to live every day worried that cancer was coming back. So even though we were certainly aware of it and watching, we really had a wonderful life. I mean, we were a regular family again. We didn't have a sick child. She was active. She had adapted well to the loss of her eye. We had a wonderful reconstructive surgeon. She had a prosthetic eye. She had glasses to protect her remaining eye, which kind of helped camouflage her prosthetic eye as well. So even though it was in the back of our mind, and I think it usually is for anybody that's faced cancer, it isn't something that you want to keep in the forefront because it's going to impact your life in a negative way.
When did the cancer come back?
When she was 8, we noticed that she really, it seemed overnight, developed a limp, and she complained about pain in her leg. So she had not had an injury. She had not fallen down. So we were immediately concerned, and we took her right to the emergency room. And they took an X-ray and said there was definitely something there and that we should contact our oncologist immediately. So we knew that we were probably back in that same situation. And our oncologist had us come in right away, and they did an MRI scan and said that she needed to have a biopsy. She went to the hospital near our house for a biopsy procedure, and that's where she was infected in the operating room with Staph aureus.
Did you know that at the time or soon after?
About 48 hours after the biopsy procedure, she started becoming ill. She had a slight fever. She didn't feel well. She had no energy. And she developed a red rash on the leg where the biopsy was. So we went back to the hospital, and we were concerned immediately that she had an infection. I think it just made sense that somebody gets sick after they've had even a minor surgery, that you would look to the surgery as the source of the problem.
And did the hospital agree? Did the people who looked at her agree?
No. At first, they sent us home and told us that she probably had the flu. The red rash on her leg, they said, could have been a reaction to the betadine or to the antiseptic that they used to wash her leg down before the surgery. And they had us, you know, go home and spend a day or two at home, see how she did. She didn't improve, so we went back. And luckily, there was a doctor in the clinic that decided to do some blood work, and he ran some kidney function tests. And that's when they found that she was basically in kidney failure. And they rushed us to the pediatric intensive care unit, and later that night, she was on a ventilator and couldn't breathe for herself.
Julia Hallisey was convinced that her daughter had an infection from the surgery, but couldn't persuade the doctors. This time, her daughter was going to need her advocacy more than ever before. And we'll return to this episode in the critical care unit in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There's an organization called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement that tries to make sense of the risks we all face inside a hospital. They've come up with an estimate that says every day in U.S. hospitals, there are some 40,000 errors or incidents, times when a patient is not getting the proper care. That's 40,000 a day. Julia Hallisey discovered this firsthand. She's a dentist in San Francisco, so she had some medical training. When her daughter Kate was diagnosed with an aggressive eye cancer soon after she was born, the family spent many long months in hospitals. The mother, Julia, learned to be a powerful patient advocate for her daughter, and she needed everything she'd learned when her girl was about 8 years old. See, Kate had been in for a biopsy on her leg, and after that surgery, she became gravely ill.
We asked repeatedly if, you know, is this related to the biopsy? Could this be an infection? Certainly my dental training had told me that this could be an infection. And the doctor in the intensive care unit said that he thought this was something else. Later that night, though, they called in an infection disease expert. They started her on heavy-duty antibiotics. So it made me think that even though they weren't telling me that they certainly were at least covering the bases for an infection. And, you know, people have asked why I didn't press them, but I think she became so critically ill so quickly, and they told us that she would likely not live through the night. So our concern was not to take them on and to demand answers at that point. It was to be at our daughter's bedside.
And what happened?
Well, she became very critically ill. She was intubated. She couldn't maintain her own blood pressure, so she had to be on pressor-type drugs to raise her blood pressure. Her kidneys failed. She ended up having to have kidney dialysis. And it was several days into this process that finally a resident came in and said, you know, we know what's wrong with your daughter. She has Staph aureus in her bloodstream. And my husband said, what does that mean? And I said, it's an infection. She had to have been infected in the operating room during her surgery. And the resident said, well, you know, it's hard to say. Staph is everywhere. It's on your hands. It's in people's nostrils. It doesn't mean that it came from the surgery. And I said, well, where else could it possibly have come from? And he said, well, you could have taken your daughter to the park, and she was playing in the park and got staph. And I said, well, you know, if that was the case, I think children all over the country would be coming into ICUs with staph infections in their blood. I think that's highly unlikely. And, you know, I'm starting to think that people here are not being totally truthful with us. And he didn't say anything, and he kind of hemmed and hawed and basically excused himself and left the room. He was a resident that we had never seen before. I felt sorry for him almost, because I think he got the sorry job of coming in and telling us that she did have an infection.
But after all you've been through together, it sounds like this was the first time when you really felt like somebody was lying to you or just not being helpful.
It was. It was a very eye-opening experience, because we had gone from people being, I thought, forthcoming, certainly sharing blood test results and chemotherapy protocols and really kind of working with us, even though we knew the system had its challenges and we were on alert. We certainly never thought we would be in a situation like that, where literally in the blink of an eye, you're in a life-threatening situation. And the hospital seems to be kind of circling the wagons a little bit. They're a little nervous. They don't want to talk to you. People don't come in the room as often. They don't make as much eye contact. When I started asking questions, they sent the risk manager down.
What's that a risk manager?
That was the first person. Risk manager is a person, sometimes a lawyer, sometimes a nurse, and all hospitals have them, and they actually manage the hospital's risk. If situations come up that could put the hospital at risk for some sort of liability.
Well, this is a legal thing rather than a medical thing.
This is a legal thing. The risk manager steps in, assesses the situation, guides the hospital how to deal with situations that could represent liability for them. So the message was loud and clear that, you know, you may be somebody we have to protect ourselves from.
And what happened to Kate through all this?
Well, she was critically ill for 7 weeks. She was on the ventilator for weeks. She ended up with severely damaged lungs. She only retained 30% of her lung function. Her kidneys did bounce back eventually. The changes in her heart and liver and things did rebound nicely. But she was very impaired with her breathing. And she also ended up having an above-the-knee amputation because, of course, we still had our original issue to deal with after 7 weeks in the intensive care. We had a very significant tumor in her leg to deal with. And we had been hoping to do a limb-sparing surgery where we could have taken out the tumor, used a metal rod, hopefully saved her leg. At least it was something that was being discussed and was an option. But after 7 weeks in the intensive care unit, when they did a new scan, they said the tumor had grown too close to her knee, that we could no longer do that surgery. And she had to have an above-the-knee amputation. So she had to learn how to walk with a heavy prosthetic leg strapped to her with only 30% of her lung function. So it was really a daily reminder of what had happened, because when we would see her struggling to walk, struggling to breathe, gasping for air, it really hit home that this had done permanent damage to her, that she had really been handicapped by all of this.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Julia Halisy and her husband decided that they'd look into the legal angle, the medical malpractice side of what happened here.
We did eventually talk to two different lawyers who advised us that nobody would take a case like this, that the fact that our daughter already had cancer was a consideration, that she was already ill, that you would never definitively be able to prove that the infection came from the surgery. The hospital ended up admitting that to us, but when you have to go into a court of law, the burden of proof is on you to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt.
But so Julia, they said if anybody could ever prove anything, I'd have thought it would be you with your binder and your record of everything that goes on.
Well, you know, the hospital admitted that the infection had to have come from the biopsy. So even with that information, the case was very weak, especially because, you know, California has MICRA laws where they limit pain and suffering awards to $250,000. So the attorneys explained to put on a malpractice case, hire expert witnesses, all of this would probably be $100,000, maybe $200,000. So even if you won the maximum award, if you do the math, it isn't worth it. And most malpractice cases don't go to court, really a small number of malpractice cases. Yes, there are some huge awards out there for really egregious cases, and most of them are people that, you know, have an income, they're supporting somebody. That's part of the reason the awards are larger. If you can show damages like that, that you're losing income, that's something that can be tacked on in addition to the pain and suffering. But for a child or an elderly person, you can't show those economic damages.
I'd have been just so angry.
Well, we did switch to a different hospital. We did end up switching to a different oncologist. So we did have a fresh start. And I'll be honest, I spent years being very angry. And as time went on, I realized that that wasn't doing anybody any good. It certainly wasn't helping me. It wasn't good for my family. It wasn't accomplishing anything to be that way. So at some point, I turned that corner and said, you know, it is what it is, and this happened, and yes, I have a lot of anger, but I need to channel that into a direction that takes me and my family and hopefully my work into a positive direction.
Julia Halisy has written a book about her experience safeguarding her daughter's health. It's called The Empowered Patient. And in it, she talks about many of the things she learned along the way. How to know who's who in the hospital, who's wearing that white coat, how to get more details from doctors. She even talks about the homemade sign she put up near her daughter's hospital bed.
I think it said something like, please wash your hands and wear gloves as appropriate.
What did you see that prompted you to put that sign up?
Well, I would see people come in and not wash their hands at all and throw on a pair of gloves. And that isn't acceptable. And a lot of people, I think, to this day don't know that. They feel very safe seeing a pair of gloves.
Yeah, I didn't know that. What's wrong with dirty hands in a pair of gloves? Aren't the gloves my comfort there?
The gloves are certainly a safety net, but every latex glove that gets put into a box is not perfect. If you look at these gloves, some of them have holes, they have contamination, they have little tears, and there's actually an acceptable quality level where there's a certain number of gloves per box that we just accept are going to have defects. When I was in dental school, we had an instructor that showed us a picture of a glove under an electron microscope. And it had a hole in it. It had a little tear. He said, this is not a used glove. This is a new glove. You know, you could find a glove or two like this in every box.
Did people take your sign seriously? I mean, did anyone say, oh, don't be ridiculous, Julie. Of course, I'm going to wash my hands and you're kind of insulting my medical intelligence by putting that sign. Or did it make a difference?
I think it made a difference because people came in and they would walk right to the sink. And it really got to the point. You know, when we put that sign up, we were very frustrated. We were very concerned. And we would actually jump up when people came in the room and stand at the edge of the bed. You know, nobody was going to get near her without washing and putting those gloves on. And after a while, they knew that. And we didn't have to jump up and stand at the end of the bed. We kind of retrained people, you know, very quickly. You know, we weren't there for an overnight visit and acting over the top. Our child had almost died from an infection. So we certainly had credibility. We had lived through this horrible situation. And I think people were happy to comply. I'm not so sure they did that in every room they went in, but they were going to do it in our room. And I tell people the story that there was a chief resident outside. He had all the residents with him. Door was open, and he was discussing my daughter's case. And he said, I just want to let you know, this mom is a little smarter than the average bear. So when you go in this room, you better know what's in that chart. You better know her name. You better know her recent blood work, because she's going to expect you to. And I sat there, and I listened, and I thought, should I be insulted? Should I feel good about that? And I decided, you know what, I'm going to feel good about that. That's a compliment. He didn't say this mom is horrible, she's combative, she's over the top. He just said, you know, she's on the ball. So you need to be on the ball when you go inside this room. Now, I would hope they'd be like that for everybody, but, you know, sometimes they're not. If you're not insistent, then they're not.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Julia Halisy talks about something else in her book, and that is the importance of reading the fine print on the hospital paperwork, in particular, those consent forms. Now, Julia only realized this when she took Kate in for another biopsy. On that day, she believed that the procedure was being done by the head of the pediatric orthopedic department. And when she saw him, she was even more convinced that he'd done the surgery.
He appeared in the waiting room. He was dressed in scrubs. He had his booties on. He had his hair covered, and he was holding a little vial of a clear preservative solution. He had a little piece of our daughter's bone in it. And he said, you know, this doesn't look like cancer to me. We won't know till the pathology comes back, but I know what osteosarcoma looks like, and I don't think this is it. So, of course, we heard encouraging news. He had walked out like he had just come from the operating room, so, you know, we never gave that a second thought until a few months later that I had requested Kate's medical records, and I was flipping through when I came to the notes about the second biopsy, and the operative report was signed by two doctors I'd never heard of. So I kept looking through, thinking this has to be some sort of a mistake, because I know that this other doctor did the biopsy, the head of the department. So I ended up calling his office, and the receptionist said, well, those are his residents. You know, he wouldn't do something like a biopsy. That's a minor procedure. So
this appearing in the waiting room was like a bit of theater?
No, I don't. I think that most surgeons feel like there's nothing wrong with substituting a resident to do surgery. And certainly, I get in a lot of trouble sometimes for saying this. Doctors aren't happy because they argue that residents have to learn. And I agree. I think he felt like, you know, there was nothing wrong with having his resident do a minor biopsy procedure. And he came out because I think on some level he knew we were expecting him. And if he sent the resident out, I might have had too many questions. Or maybe he just felt, you know, he was the one who was available to come out and talk to us. But certainly, while I don't think it was this big theatrically planned ruse or anything, I think that it gives people the idea that somebody is doing the surgery when they're not. So what I would like to see, I don't propose that you never have a resident work on you. And people ask me all the time, oh, I bet you've never let a resident work on you. And I said, that's not true. But I want to know who that resident is. I want to meet them. I would have the same questions for them I would have for the surgeon. How many times have you done this? So I went back and I looked at the consent form. A couple of words jumped out at me. The form starts by saying, you know, I authorize Dr. blank, and then it's filled in with the surgeon's name. And then it says in tiny little letters, and associates. That's what our form said back then. They've changed them around. Every hospital might have something slightly different. But when you look at the form, you did just sign your consent for the doctor and or their resident students, whoever, to do the procedure. So if you feel that your surgery really requires the expertise of a certain surgeon, maybe you have something unusual, something rare, if you just want to be sure that this is the doctor doing your surgery, you know, number one, you need to communicate that. You need to discuss that ahead of time with the doctor. And on the consent form, you need to cross out the part that says, and associates, and others, and interns, residents, whatever. And you need to initial that.
And you've done
that.
And
you need, I've done that. We spent a lot of time trying to find good surgeons. So certainly we wanted that person's expertise. You know, a child with metastatic cancer, we didn't feel was a case for a resident. We just felt better having somebody who was not a student do things for our daughter. If I needed my appendix out, that would be a different situation. I don't think I'd have a problem having a resident do that. Residents do have to learn, yeah. And that's how they learn, is by doing. But I think it needs to be done with transparency. We need to be honest about that with patients. We need to tell them that Dr. So-and-so is going to be assisted by this person, or this person is going to be doing your surgery. And you need to meet that person. You need to be able to ask them your questions. And I think their name should go on the consent form.
Julia Halisy's daughter, Kate, never did overcome all the obstacles that she faced with her eye cancer. Kate Halisy died when she was 11. But she watched her mother, Julia, fighting for her. and she wound up as one of the people encouraging her mother to write the book, The Empowered Patient. I'll talk more with Julia about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Julia Halisy spent 10 years in and out of hospitals overseeing her daughter's care. Her daughter Kate had an aggressive form of eye cancer, and the complications from that disease eventually took her life at age 11. Kate's mother Julia says early on, watching the care of her daughter, she started compiling notes about Kate's medicines and hospital procedures. Soon she brought a notebook in and decided to write down all the lessons she was learning. And she did have the time to do it.
In the hospital, my daughter loved to watch cartoons, which after a while started driving me crazy. I needed something else to do. So I would bring this notebook, and I started writing down all the things that we had learned. So now we know how to be sure that these things don't happen to us again. And you know, she'd say, don't forget this, or talk about putting the sign above my bed, or talk about, you know, not forgetting the flush, which is a little saline solution you push through the lines after the medication, because nurses would forget that a lot. So they would actually have to push in medication and then say, oh, I forgot the flush, and they'd have to take off their gloves, they'd have to leave the room, get the flush. Then we'd have to remind them, please wash your hands, put the gloves on again. And she said, you know, mention that, because she knew that that was inefficient and it put her more at risk, and she knew that. So after a while, I told her, you know, I have so much information here, this could be a book. And she said, you know what, we have to do a book. And I thought, you know what, you're right. I think people are amazed when they look through the book and say, wow, I have a lot more power and control than I think I do. And these things aren't that hard.
I have a question for you, Julia. Kate died at the age of 11 in the year 2000. And I'm sorry about that. You guys went through so much. When you look back at that time and you look at the book, do you see it as a kind of a memorial or a testament to what she went through, what you went through? Do you see it as a don't get mad, get even? How do you look back on it?
I don't think I see it that way at all. I see it as honoring her memory. This is something that she thought was important, that she thought could help other people. But I think it honors what she went through, not by saying we're going to get even or, you know, we're going to do an expose, but by saying learn from what happened, because that's really what she was about. She was a very happy child. And, you know, amazingly enough, she was not angry about what happened to her. She was a little matter of fact that, you know, I've been through a lot. You know, she just, I think, accepted the fact that she was going to have more challenges than other people.
I mean, do you get the kind of feedback from people or from the medical profession that gives you the satisfaction of knowing that this does make a difference, this has made a difference?
I had a patient come in and tell me that she was getting blood drawn and the woman was typing on a computer keyboard, entering her information. She turned around, grabbed gloves, put them on, and she said, oh, you know, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I should have mentioned to you that I just don't feel comfortable unless I see people wash their hands and wear gloves. And the woman said, oh, you know, absolutely. No problem. I should have done that.
Do you get any feedback from within the medical profession, people saying, this can help, this can make a difference to us?
Well, nurses have always been positive. They see the benefit of that because they're right there at the bedside. I've had a couple of doctors give me some feedback and say that they didn't like reading some of the things in the book, but they're true.
And how are you? now? I mean, that's been quite a roller coaster for you. How are you doing?
You know, I think we're doing fine. We have a son in college. My younger son is 15. I think, you know, that we have given them a good life, that we've stayed positive, that we didn't want to let our loss impact their lives, that they felt that we never recovered. We were determined not to let that happen. And I think we both found a path where we felt like we could honor our daughter's memory.
Would Kate be pleased?
I think she'd be very pleased. I have no doubt.
Julia Halisy joined us from a studio in San Francisco. Her book's called The Empowered Patient, and you can read more about that. Go to our website at thestory.org. One of the most interesting files of stories that we find ourselves putting together here at The Story is the one about things that are lost and then found, or things that are misplaced or forgotten and then rediscovered years later. I mean, we've talked about lost rings and bricks from old schools and rediscovered items of clothing. Helen Tsatsos called in with a story that features her grandmother, her Yaya, and the unexpected discovery of a photo thousands of miles away. When Helen was in her 20s, she was shepherding a couple of younger relatives to Greece, the family's ancestral home. Before she left, though, she went to see her grandmother, who'd been born there.
I kind of went over to spend the night with her and just gather some information about her family and who I was going to meet when I went over that summer. And she and I were looking at the photos and talking about Greece. And we looked through a big stack of pictures, and she showed me just a few of the artifacts that she had, that she had kept with her from when she was a young woman. You know, obviously, she grew up in the day before snapshots and digital cameras and all that stuff. And there were lots of pictures from studios, pretty formal, with these kind of distinguishing backgrounds. There's a great picture of my dad my dad was the oldest of four, and there's a picture of him.
How does your grandmother look in those photographs?
She just looks serious, even though she wasn't such a serious person.
Maybe at that age she was. I mean, she was put in an arranged marriage, sent off to America. I'd probably have a serious look on my face, too.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
Helen Tsatsos didn't really connect with that serious image of her grandmother, seeing her dressed up and posed in the old photo. She knew her more affectionately, as I said earlier, as her Yaya.
One of my strong memories is going over there on Sunday afternoons. We go pile in the station wagon and go over there on Sundays after church for Greek chicken. It sounds awful. I just remember her as a little old lady, you know, kind of hunched and white hair, always set and always wearing kind of old lady dresses, but always perfectly put together. And she had her arthritis socks, and she always wore white Nikes, perfectly white, never a spot on them.
Did she tell you anything about Greece? Did she like to tell stories about where she'd come from?
Well, she'd been in the States for many, many years. She moved when she was about 18, I think. And I think she felt herself as an American, although always with a very, very thick Greek accent. I mean, American. So she would relay how much she loved Greece and she loved Athens and she missed her family, but not so much in a way that she felt like she had to move back. But she did have lots of photos in boxes.
Do you remember as a child looking at those photographs, going through them?
Not as a child. I mean, I expect they were too precious for her just to show all the children. And she also, I mean, in an odd way, wasn't nostalgic. There's things about her that were very, very nostalgic, but I think she was really quite a practical person and didn't live in the past, so to speak.
That generation kind of had to be that way, though, didn't they, in a way?
I think so. I mean, you had to be very pragmatic about moving on, you know, with following the American dream and keeping moving forward as an American, I suppose.
But back to our story. Helen Tsatsos set off for Greece. Now, she was nowhere near Athens, where her grandmother was from. Instead, she went to Kolymnos, where her host family was living. And then she took a side trip of her own to the island of Rhodes to rest and relax. So Helen's there on the island, just wandering around, and she makes a most unusual discovery.
I wasn't looking for anything. I was just wandering, just sort of passing time. And I just wandered into the shop and picked up a stack of pictures and was thumbing through them, and I found this photo that I had just seen not too long ago at my grandma's house. And I remember I started just screaming, oh, my gosh, this is my yaya. And I was holding it up. And then I remember the shopkeeper nodding really patronizingly and thinking, oh, yeah, here's some American who thinks this woman's her yaya. Okay, so I remember her selling it to me for a lot of money.
So what was it like for you to see that photograph there?
Oh, I was just trembling. I really just started trembling. And I might have started crying. I don't remember. But it was just so powerful to me to have that connection. You know, I mean, when people say, what are you? I say, I'm Greek. But really, I'm American. I'm American of Greek descent. And there's some customs that I retain, mostly customs to do with food. To find that just gave me such a strong connection to that country and to my family and to my roots, I guess you could say. So it's real powerful to me.
And how did you really know it was your yaya?
I had seen that same picture at her house.
The exact same picture?
Me. Yeah, the exact same photo. I mean, I recognized my yaya, but it was also literally a copy of the same photo that she had. And, you know, it was so uncanny because she wasn't from Rhodes. She'd come to the States 60 years prior to that. I mean, there was really no explanation as to how that photo got to that place. And, of course, how I found it is kind of a miracle, I guess.
Now, did you say she was the only one in the photo?
No, it's a photo of her and a friend of hers. And my yaya has her arm draped over her friend's shoulder. And I remember her telling me, as we were going through these photos at her house before my trip, she pointed that one out and said, oh, that was her good friend. And they took this picture before my yaya came to the United States to be married. So
she'd have been, what, 16, 17 years old?
17, 18, yeah. Something like that.
And what are they wearing, these two young women, then?
They were wearing kind of strange dresses, actually, these long woolen dresses, long-sleeved. My grandma's has a striped pleated skirt on them, and her friend had a dark dress on also. It's black and white, of course. And they look kind of somber but happy in the photo. I guess as you would if you knew your life was going to change in a big way.
Now, you said your grandmother had never, to the best of your knowledge, never even been to the Isle of Rhodes, right?
That's correct.
So are you able to figure out what that photograph is doing in that shop?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of speculation. There was no story as to how it got from Athens to Rhodes and how it had been preserved so well. I guess the thing that I think is probably, well, there was a stamp on the back of the photo that I found, and it was the photographer's stamp. It was probably some stockpile photo that something like that.
Lot for $5, right? Everything in the
exactly,
box.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I got you. What condition was the photo in, Helen?
Oh, immaculate, perfect condition.
So what did you do? Did you, you know, fold it up in another piece of paper?
I think I just carried it, Dick. I don't really remember. I think it was just, I held it really close for the rest of the trip.
And this was roughly how long ago?
This is about 20 years ago.
Yeah, so you probably wouldn't have made a transatlantic call to say, guess what, right?
Right. No, yeah, exactly. There weren't phone calls like that. I mean, geez, 20 years ago, no, you wouldn't have done that.
So tell me about bringing it home.
Yeah, well, I came back from Rhodes to Kalymnos and tried to explain to the host family what had happened to me and what I had found. And, you know, I was kind of doing this with mime and my very limited Greek and trying to get my little cousins to explain. And Katina and Michali, the people we were staying with, they couldn't really understand. They were kind of shaking their head and kind of nodding.
And why is this American girl so excited over an old photograph?
Yeah, exactly. Thinking,
right?
And then about a week later when my cousins arrived and I told them, then they told Katina and Michali what happened. And it was just kind of like all hell broke loose. The candles came out. The incense came out. Everyone was doing their crosses, looking at the skies, looking at me like I was a witch. Fana yemu. They didn't know what, you know, how could this happen?
So when all the candles come out and people are crossing themselves, what are they doing with the photograph at this point? Do they have it up on the mantle or do they think it's maybe a little bit black magic and you can take it and put it away, please?
I think it was more like that. It was kind of some element of, you know, it's still very superstitious culture. I mean, it's just completely weird. I mean, thousands and thousands of miles away and many, many years away from its origin. I was just real lucky, I guess.
Helen Tsatsos is telling me about the unexpected discovery she made in Greece of a photo of her grandmother. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Helen still had the most important person to show this photo to, and that was her grandmother.
I guess my favorite part of the story that kind of tells the most about my grandma is, you know, I couldn't wait to take it to her house, and she was a little hard of hearing, so I didn't bother trying to explain it to her over the phone. I just went over there, and I told her the story. I was wandering around. I went to this antique store, and here's what I found, and showed her the picture and said, you know, yeah, look what I found. My yaya took the picture in her hand and looked at it and said, Helen, couldn't you have found a better picture of me?
What do you say to that?
Completely deadpan. I looked around and my mom just shook her head and kind of laughed. I said, but yeah, don't you understand? Like, I found this in Rhodes and you're here and you're from Athens, and just didn't faze her at all. And later I talked to my mom because I was kind of a little crushed. This is a great story. And my mom speculated that that my grandma was a little miffed that I said that I found it at an antique store, that it aged her. So
did you pull out the other photograph and hold the two of them side by side?
Yes. Yes, we did. It was like, look, see, this is the same picture. And
Was it same stamp, all that stuff?
No. You know what? Her picture didn't have the stamp. So I don't know.
Curiouser and curiouser.
I guess since I don't read Greek and I don't speak Greek, I didn't feel, I guess, motivated to pursue who and where and all that. I mean, to me, the magic was enough that I found it, mm-hmm. and it kind of drew an even stronger connection between me and my grandma and me in Greece, I guess.
And where's that photograph now, Helen?
At my home. It's pride of place. I put it in a really pretty antique picture frame, and I hung it on the wall by my stairs, so I see it every time I go up and down the stairs, every single day.
And what do you think when you see it?
You know, I get a kick out of it. It's I think what a life they must have had, you know, to come and have that kind of change in their life, you know, new country, new language, new everything, and how lucky I am that they did that. Kind of how richer my life is for that.
Your grandmother's passed on, right?
Yes, she died.
Does it remind you of her? I mean, and I ask you the question because she was so dismissive of it. I wonder if it just sort of more connects you with your ancestry rather than her.
Yeah, no. You know, it absolutely connects me to her. She was dismissive of that, but I never felt like she was dismissive of me or any of her grandchildren or her family. I think for her it was the connection, so... Yeah, it makes me think of her and just how much I love my grandma. She was a funny person. I have another story about her that I was just reminded of this morning as I was thinking about doing this interview with you. When I was about 20 or so, a few years before all this with the picture, she gave me a jewelry box, like a white, you know, little cardboard jewelry box tied up with a ribbon. She said, here, Helen, Eleni, this is for you. And I thought, I'll get a little treat from my grandma. And I opened it up, and it was two plastic grapes with teeth marks in them that she had saved from one time when I was really little and pulled the plastic grapes off the dining room table and thought they were real and chewed them, and she kept them. I thought, you know, that was precious to her.
No, that's really interesting, right? Because what it does is it kind of exposes a side of her that does, you know, play in the land of nostalgia and memory. I'll put these away. I'll give them to her when she's older. Show her what a bad child she was.
Yeah, but it wasn't not, I mean, I don't
more like a twinkle
charming.
In the eye thing. You know?
Yeah. Twinkle in the eye, exactly. So I still have those grapes.
Well, wherever your grandmother is now, I hope she takes some flattery in the fact that we'll put her photograph on our website, not in an antique shop, something brand new and modern and wonderful.
Very contemporary.
Helen Tsatsos joined me from a studio in Chicago. If you have a story about finding something that you didn't even know was lost, or one of these magical family moments, let me know. I love these stories. Go to our website at thestory.org. Leave me a couple of lines there. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.